From New York City, the world-famous Comedy Cellar presents Live from America Podcast. Live from America Podcast. With Noam Dorman and Hatem Gabber. Live from America Podcast. Where the top experts in the world and the best comics in the nation get together weekly to discuss today's issues as they cover news, culture, politics, comedy, and more with an equal part of knowledge and comedy. And now, here are your hosts, Hatem Gabber and Noam Dorman.
All right, hello and welcome. This is Hatem alongside me, Noam Dorman, owner of the Comedy Cellar, and he's welcoming you his way with some of stolen music from our people. And this is Live from America Podcast.
Not bad, right?
Yeah. And for people that are listening, he's actually playing that. It's crazy. Let's start. We have an amazing show, an amazing guest, our good friend and regular on this show, comedian Boris Eiking. Good to see
you. Hello. Good to see you, too.
And just in time for the new James Bond movie, our guest of honor is retired senior CIA operation officer and the author of my new favorite book, The Recruiter, Spying and the Lost Art of American Intelligence. Douglas London is here. How are you?
Great. Happy to be here.
Good to see you.
And he is that your real name?
Well, it depends who's asking.
I mean, if I was going to make up a secret agent name, Douglas London is pretty on point.
Isn't it a cool name? It's great, but it's what I came with.
Either a spy or a porn star. You would have had to be one of the two.
Yeah, I don't know where my talent lies best, but time will tell.
So thank you so much for being here. He's calling from a secret location. He's not, but it makes that sound cooler if we say that. So we can disclose the... welcome and thank you for the book. I can't stop. It's really good. It's called The Recruiter. It just came out a couple of days ago, correct? On the 26th of September?
28th of September, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Congratulations. Great book. So we want to discuss a lot about it, but also we have some CIA questions that... would love to ask you first. First question for me is, used to be CIA operation officers and that whole world used to be secret. You cannot write books, even movies are like not based in like true events and all that. And now it's like, you guys, like, we know who you are, you know what you did, you know, where you were stationed, all that. Like, when did that shift?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. You know, back in the 70s, I think when the first book started to come out by people such as Philip Agee, who, you know, essentially defected, if you would, from the agency of the United States, there was actually no law against, there was laws against leaking classified information, but no laws requiring reviews of, you know, works by intelligence officials and such. And that changed, of course, after that. But the dynamic, I think, changed by the culture, you know, with the advent of social media and transparency. And I think even the intelligence community, for its own benefit, tried to become a bit more transparent after 9/11 based on the appropriate recriminations it suffered for 9/11. So I think it was sort of a mood shift that opened the gates, but not entirely. There's still a real tough review process. My book went through a lot of changes and redactions to accommodate the agency.
What'd they take out?
A fair bit of good stuff. A fair bit of good stuff. I think sometimes they were willing to negotiate because there were issues that seemed they were more embarrassed by than were actually compromising in terms of sources and methods. And to your point, I actually don't and can't say where I was stationed. In my book, I can't say what country I was in. I can't specify the nationality of the agents. And I have to sort of provide what I think is the most important part, their heart and soul, their humanity, but without anything that would be physically descriptive enough to identify them.
Yeah, I kind of noticed in the book, the names were like you can, you, and you always say like, almost saying these are fake names, obviously, some of them. But I like how you like in a bio also, and now we had a lot of CIA operations. I was like, you ask, oh, well, we work in the Middle East and Asia. I was like, Yeah. Where else? You work in Sweden? Of course you work in the Middle East, Asia. Like, where else we have problems, you know?
Yeah, they'll let you talk about places you travel to. Mm-hmm. And I could even sometimes include places I've lived in as places mm-hmm. I've traveled to. But they're sensitive because of equities in terms of offending a country or compromising a cover platform we might have used.
Yeah.
How does that relate to, they just had an episode on the New York Times podcast, The Daily. I don't know if this was like an into, but they had a whole thing about the CIA like 2 days ago that yeah. there was a mass message that went out to all operatives. Basically, they were like, a lot of our sources have been compromised, whether killed or taken into prison. And it was like an unusual thing. And they did a whole thing about the CIA, and their perspective was basically like, they're not what they used to be, and they're losing sources, and they're having trouble spying because now all these, you know, nation states have a lot more technological capability. I think they mentioned Iran as having like their own really good, and all this stuff that made it sound, you know, they really shit talked your organization to the point where I was like, is this a CIA thing? Are they trying to put it out there that they don't know what they're doing so that everybody thinks that they can like get a one up on the CIA now? What's going on with that?
That's the great thing about conspiracy theories. And you know,
there's a lot of great things about
it out there. No, they're awesome, right? And everybody wants to hear about them and think about them. It's difficult for me to discuss because on one hand, my whole book's about the cultural change of the agency and how it's degraded it somewhat, and particularly in the areas of tradecraft and the whole recruitment and handling of sources. But most importantly, that cable should have never been leaked. I think that's not the way you do business. And my desire is to see the agency correct itself and account internally within the government and within those who can hear and see and make the right changes, but not sort of putting things out there that weaken it or actually, more importantly, affect the safety of our agents overseas.
It actually was also, after you mentioned it, Boris, I looked it up and it was an article the next day in the New York Times, like a big article about like losing a lot of assets. And I don't know if, you know, why is that? And when they say a lot, do they mean a lot in one country, I assume, you know?
Or it was sent globally. They said, I mean, according to that podcast, they said it was sent out to every single CIA field agent as like a red alert. I mean, I'm sure you know more about
that. I haven't got any alerts, so.
I left my buzzer off. I'm sorry.
Or unless they're willing to sacrifice me. So, so in your book, we're going to discuss, as I said, your book a little bit. But also, you know, you recruited a lot of people, you know, and you work in that. And recruitment is, in my opinion, is always about gaining leverage. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. I think it's yes, leverage, but not what people expect. I think from the movies and TV and such like that, folks expect dirty tricks in espionage. They expect coercion, they expect blackmail, you know, dirty pictures, whatever like that, but that actually doesn't work. Leverage to a case officer is levering somebody's needs and interests, because recruiting an agent, you're asking someone to take a tremendous risk, perhaps risking their life and certainly that of their family, if not their family's lives, but their reputation, their equity, the ability of their children to go to school or get jobs in that country. So you don't want to blackmail someone into doing that. You need them signed on, because if they're providing secrets upon our decision makers have to make life and death decisions, you know, do we go to war? Do we, you know, pull out our investment in a government, whatever it may be, drastic if it's lethal or drastic if it's economic? You want to be sure of that information. And somebody who's being blackmailed, how can you ever be sure, you know, what their answers are? So you want it to be a partnership. So yeah, it's leverage and it's manipulation. I acknowledge that fully and certainly in my book, but it's identifying sort of what's inside of them. What do they want me that you can help them attain so that they're a full, you know, committed partner to the endeavor, which can be really risky for them and sometimes the case officer.
So basically you don't want them to know they're being blackmailed.
Because it's not blackmailed. And, you know, I would tell you, it's not ethics. If blackmail worked, I would have used it.
Yeah.
I was a spy.
I think it's kind of like torture, right? Like you could torture somebody to a certain extent until they just going to say whatever you want to say, want them to say.
And I think we saw that in the investigations about the enhanced interrogation program that the agency unfortunately used. So what you want is somebody that you could validate and test, and you need to be able to get them to a point in the relationship where they think it's in their interest, they think it's in their own need. And it could be as pure and patriotic as wanting to rise up against Putin because it's a horrible system, or because they want revenge. Or it could be that they have a need, such as a child who has leukemia, who's sick, that they don't have the funds to pay for. And their commitment to you is based on a need that you have to constantly assess, that's to see that it's genuine and it's true. But that's really what you want in an agent relationship. If I'm going to meet somebody in the back streets of a dangerous country where I myself am under threat, I'm in Beirut or Karachi or something like that, do I want somebody who I've blackmailed that I'm putting my life in their hands as well? I don't think so. So really, while it's great movies, and I will tell you a lot of services use it, the Russians absolutely use blackmail all the time. Iran uses blackmail, Pakistan, because it's easier, it's quicker. And recruiting somebody where you're actually making a connection that could be where you get your relationship to where it's more than about us, right? Where they believe they're doing something for whatever path, for their family, for their country or whatever. That takes time. That takes breaking down barriers. That takes a sense of trust, which is more like that of a confessional.
Oh. So if we start from the start, how did you become a CIA officer? Were you recruited?
I actually was, as a matter of fact. So back in my days, it was before the internet and, you know, cell phones, and we had cave drawings, but we didn't have much else in terms of social media, right? So I was in school, I was in college, and I wanted to do something in international affairs. I had a great interest in history and country, though I never traveled anywhere. I grew up in the Bronx. And from a pretty poor family. So my first like airplane flight was going to boot camp in the Marine Corps when I went to fly to South Carolina. But I studied all international affairs with a really inspiring guy who taught at my school. He was a career foreign service officer. He'd been an ambassador. He'd retired and he taught as an adjunct, you know, because it was of interest to him and he didn't live far from the school. And he was like the most impressive human being I'd ever met. He was eloquent, he was articulate, he was unbelievably knowledgeable, and I was still speaking English like at a learner's level compared to him, right? And so that's what I wanted to be. But I think, and to his credit, he probably thought that, you know, this kid from the Bronx wasn't really a good fit for the diplomatic service, you know, the sort of, you know, more refined attitude and perspective, but he thought I might make a good spot. And he was in touch with the agency because one of the things he did in his retirement was he would surface the names of foreign diplomats that came across his scope that he thought might be interested in maybe having a relationship with the agency and might be approachable. And he named me as somebody who might be a good candidate to come into the service. So my first engagement with them was a phone call where I got this, you know, call from somebody identifying themselves as a federal government official, talk about being specific. Mm-hmm. And offering me the opportunity to come to a job fair, no further details, but I was, you know, interested in a job. So I did it and found out who it was and what it was. But, you know, your point is right. In the 80s, when I came in, there wasn't as much out about the agency. So everything I believed about the agency came from, you know, James Bond movies or, you know, other spy novels or Mission Impossible and such. And I found out it was different in a lot of ways, but in a lot of ways, a lot more neat and more aligned for me and my kind of personality.
Hmm. That's great. And then
did people know about MK Ultra then yet?
Say again?
Did people know about MK Ultra at that time yet?
There was already talk about LSD and all the trials and such like that as sort of, you know, urban myth or true, depending on your perspective. I don't know that like the fully refined, oh, this was the name and such was out there, but people were talking about it already. You got to remember, this is the early 80s. So the 70s was a real tough time for the agency. You know, we were coming out of the Vietnam War, all the covert action, and more importantly, Watergate, the church committees, which investigated the agency. So the agency had been purged a bit. There was what was called the Halloween Massacre, where they fired about 800 Directorate of Operations officers under Stansfield Turner, the director at that time. And the agency was not really well thought of back then. And believe it or not, kind of growing up at the time, probably had a worse reputation in the early 80s than it does, now.
What is that on Halloween? Is that why it's called Halloween Massacre?
Yeah, they're all fired. They got their pink slips on Halloween. Yeah.
Just in costume, a bunch of sad CIA agents.
I think you can picture it that way. It kind of looks cool if you do, if they're trench coats and masks and stuff like that. But no, I think it was a bit more bureaucratic.
So you just got a phone call and says like, hey, we want you to, you know, do this and do this. Because I get a lot of phone calls that says that I want money, but, you know, it's never actually true. It's like, you know, and I'm kind of offended because I think I can make the perfect spy for any country. It's open invitation if anybody's listening, you know. Because I think it's going to be so cool. Did you have to keep it secret from your family and friends?
So they're good about telling you that you depends on how much of a burden it is for your immediate family. You obviously tell your spouse if you have a spouse, because they have to be a partner to you in a lot of ways, even if they're not inside the organization. And I chose to tell my mom, but my mom was very disappointed, actually, and not because she had a thing about the CIA. You know, she wanted me to get a, you know, why would I ever want to leave New York City? You know, you're a nice boy, get a good job. Merrill Lynch might hire you in the management trainee. Why would you want all this mishigas and run around the world? So I think she was a bit crushed and never really understood what the agency was anytime. So until she died, when people would ask her, so what does your son do? She would go, he works for the government. And that's what she thought in her mind. It wasn't that she was trying to protect my cover. That's She just didn't distinguish the CIA from the IRS or, you know, the general printing office.
Oh, that's nice. I would never keep it a secret. I would just tell everybody.
Yeah, that might get in your way, though, you know, that whole kind of secrecy and cover business.
It depends where you're looking to gain.
Yeah, that's true. But,
so what were you, like, every, like, intelligence around the world, where were you rate them? Because we always hear the Mossad, blah, blah, blah. You know, where do you heat, rate the intelligence from around the world? Like, who's the best in general, like right now?
Well, I still think CIA is the best. I think the agency has lost a few steps. I think 20 years of focusing on paramilitary activities, covert action, I think degraded a bit of its investment in traditional tradecraft, particularly with the impact of technology, you know, biometrics, cities wired cameras everywhere, how to use secretly, because you have to do it securely, recruit and handle agents. So I'd say the agency is still the best at it. I think that a lot of services have taken very good advantage in leveraging technology. Certainly the Chinese, the Iranians, the Russians have, variously from using it for messaging to meddle in the affairs of other governments and elections, to all the cyber activity where they're using cyber to collect intelligence instead of recruiting agents. I still don't believe there's another foreign intelligence service which comes as close to CIA in its ability to recruit agents. I think Mossad is pretty good. I think the British are pretty good, even the French. But the Russian, really their technique still tends to be leverage. They like blackmail. They like seeing a way to exploit somebody's vulnerabilities. So we talk about in the business motivations, right? Things that people want to do, and vulnerabilities, things that could hurt them. So I say in my book, and I praise the agency for it, their approach is motivation. Find a reason that somebody wants to take these tremendous risks, where other services will look for vulnerabilities. You know, do they have a drinking problem? Do they have a gambling problem? Are they cheating on their spouse? You know, are they in the closet from their lifestyle for whatever reason in this day and age that they don't want to come out? And those are the kind of things that they like to leverage.
Why is one better than the other? Or which one, why do you praise them for it?
The reason I praise motivation, as I was saying earlier, you've got to stand behind your intelligence, right? So when we collect intelligence, it's called raw report, right? It's not been fully evaluated. So you've recruited an agent. Your agent is an official, let's say the agent's a foreign military officer, okay? And you need to collect that person's intelligence and stand behind it with a source description, which is telling the consumers, the decision makers who read it, the experts who study the country, how much faith can you put in this report? How much faith can you put in that asset? You need them to be a partner in that relationship where they are fully committed to working with you, and you have the ability to test them over time to see, have they been telling the truth about what they really do for a living? Are they really a military officer? Do they really work in this particular office? Are they trying to deceive you? Are they trying to redirect you? or are they giving you legitimate information? The better you can do that, the more reliable the intelligence is to make a decision. If you have an agent who's being blackmailed or coerced, you can never get past that to really stand behind that agent, that this agent wants to provide truthful information. In a case of blackmail, maybe they are, maybe they're not, but how could you really be sure? So it's really your advantage. And as I was saying earlier, I have to meet this agent secretly, because the idea is that you've got to protect their contact with you, the CIA, the US government. It has to be concealed. It's not like the movies where two people stand on a train platform in the light of day. You don't want anyone, any sort of witness, be it a person or be it technology like a camera. So if I'm meeting this person in back alleys or various sort of sketchy environments, that person could just as well set me up. That person could at any time go to their service, blackmail me, have me killed, whatever the case might be. That's not what you want. So the more they're motivated, whether it's from an ideological cause, because you know they don't like communism, or they think the regime in Tehran is repressive, or they have a need that you are reliable in helping to meet. And it could be an altruistic need, taking care of their family, health, medical, or it could be they want revenge. They've been screwed over by somebody in the service. They're disgruntled, and this is their way to get back. You want them to be motivated, not vulnerable. And that's—
Or maybe they want to live here. They want to be American and live, escape that regime.
In some cases, people do, but that's really hard. It's not as easy as people think. The demands of getting relocation are very, very high. Now, Afghanistan was a unique situation where we broke it, we owned it, right? So we did the right thing by those who were working with us, not just as agents, but as part of the Afghan government. But traditionally, for an agent to get resettlement in the United States, they have to provide an incredibly impactful amount of intelligence, go through exhaustive investigation to be seen that they're really legit. And it's not something that comes overnight. If you're like a Russian defector who's giving us the codes to their hypersonic missiles, yeah, you can pretty much bank you're going to get resettled. But if you're from, you know, any number of other countries, your intelligence might be really valuable. But to get that worth, then you're probably going to be working with us for at least a long period of time. And the impact of your intelligence has to be pretty significant, too.
I think from the three of us over here, probably Boris is the easiest one to recruit. I have a feeling. You can tell him the earth is not round.
Well, he's been chatting with Fury on the side, so I can see that. That's all right.
What if we can't motivate them? We wouldn't use blackmail?
So you can't recruit everybody. You know, some people are simply not recruitable. I believe that most people, given the right circumstances at the right time in space, time, and history, might be recruitable, but not everybody is. I know you still wouldn't use blackmail because, again, you get back to that same dynamic that how could you trust them if you're blackmailing? You can say, what if they're documents? What if those documents are being fabricated for you because you think you're blackmailing them, but they've gone to the local service? And this is all a big scam and they're setting you up. There's a real different dynamic with an agent who's part of the process, who's a partner in it. And that's the relationship you want. And you can test more effectively by somebody who's invested in it than somebody who's being dragged, kicking and screaming.
What happened if you try to recruit somebody and then you failed? Like, aren't you in danger?
Well, I tell you, I've been rejected a lot in my life. I mean, you get used to rejection. Usually you're rejected before you get to the point of a pitch. You just know it's not going to work because you don't want to pitch somebody. And basically, you know, we talk about pretending to be like Clark Kent and then you like open up your clothes to be like Superman. You don't want to reveal who you are because that's compromising. That could get you in trouble. That could be embarrassing to the government. But, case officers are always on the troll, right? They're always on the prowl. They're always trying to develop people and start cultivating relationships. Some people just want nothing to do with it. They smell it out early on. They just kind of sense it. Or in the case of the most important agents, these are people who aren't allowed social contact with the US government anyway. Yeah. So a Russian, Chinese, an Iranian, a North Korean, it's not like they're allowed to go out to Starbucks with us and just hang and chill. You know, they already are crossing the line if they take a non-reported contact. So you get rejected, and that's kind of part of it. I think that's really hard for a lot of our new trainees when they come in. You know, one of the points I make in my book and that I've made to the agency is we need to go after a more diverse group of people because we tend to go after folks who've lived fairly comfortable, privileged lives who aren't used to things going wrong for them. And to be a good case officer, you got to know what to do when things go wrong, because it's really easy for them to go off the rail. And in training, they're not used to rejection. They're not used to sometimes scenarios where they're going to fail. If you're a Star Trek fan, Kobayashi Maru, right? We want them to fail and see how they do with it. And it's sometimes, a minimum, I would say, very unsettling for them.
Yeah. I'll tell you a story. We never confirmed that it's true to an extent of if what he was a CIA operative. But back when I was young, growing up in Egypt, there was the American Center in Alexandria. And they used to throw a lot of parties there, obviously. And we all know why. They probably tried to recruit something. But anyway, in the Olympic development program, they will invite a lot of athletes, a lot of teams. And one of my friends, he was like shaking, like he could tell like he could be recruited. And they offer him to take him to France and around the world to develop his talent and maybe recruit him as a member of the American Olympic team. And then after that, they were claimed that they were trying to recruit him. Like he claimed that they tried to recruit him. He never came back. And that guy of the center was transferred. But that's one way, I guess, right? Try to find somebody's dream. And
well, you know, it's the first, the most important thing is, what is their access? Do they have access to secrets? The CIA steals secrets. I mean, that's the job. So we don't just recruit people because, well, we want to know an Egyptian who'll talk to us honestly. We'd want an Egyptian who had access to foreign ministry secrets, military.
I think
secrets.
His dad was in the military.
And that could be indirectly, but it may have only been sort of a layer to get close, because that's a lot of time and investment. And then what's the point? I mean, how much is he going to learn from his dad anyway? But what you're talking about in terms of, you know, the whining and dining, you want them to feel appreciated. What's most important to an agent is to feel that somebody really cares about them. Somebody really loves them. Some of our agents are people who are not necessarily the nicest and best people in the world. And sometimes it's the agency that gives them an outlet, that gives them recognition. You know, you really are great. We love you, you know, too much. That sometimes is enough, but it's at least always a component. The agent always has to think he or she is the center of the world for their case officer and for the CIA.
Sounds like dealing with comedians, a lot of narcissists and mentally unstable people that you have to make sure can perform at their best.
See, that could be my transition career. Maybe being an agent, a talent agent, recruiting comedians.
There you go. And you probably can. Oh, no, I don't know if you need, I meant to tell you that story. I don't know if you know this, but the first call, you know, when Sadat went to Israel, you know who made that call to arrange Sadat's visit to, who was the prime minister of Israel at the time?
Begin?
Yeah. You know who made that call? Omar Sharif.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I just read a book about his memory, and he was called by Sadat, and Sadat told him, like, listen, you close to both sides. I want you to tell them I'm real, and I want to, I want to go and visit and sign peace contract. It's. I'll send you the article. It's an amazing story. But yeah, like to Boris's point, maybe some actors, maybe some. You never know. Somebody charismatic, you know, can be a perfect spy.
They'd have to be able to do something that's like secret and special. So. You know, there are agents of influence.
Yeah.
There's a category of agent where you want an agent simply to be able to provide a narrative to change a point of view in a country or to influence
Don Lemon
decisions. John Jim would have been a perfect one, but I'm sure he did it on his own. But you know, actually, that's something that the agency doesn't do as much of, which I hope it does again.
I think they did a lot of it during the Arab Spring, because there's a lot of TV hosts and a lot of people that came here later on, you know, escape that helped that.
Well, there were certainly covert influence efforts, but I think there could be even more investments in that, because you should also have a public effort. I don't think the United States, I mean, that's a whole other conversation, right? What did the United States do during the Arab Spring? I think they responded catastrophically.
Yeah.
But had they responded better, they would have had an actual policy, which they didn't have for the Arab Spring, because they had sort of a different approach to each country and didn't really know what they wanted to do. But they would have then complemented it theoretically with a covert program, where your point is right. Could we recruit somebody who's really popular in that country to provide a narrative that fits our interest, the United States, and maybe change his opinion in a certain way in that country?
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm open for recruitment, FYI. So let's talk about your book. Okay. So it's captured the best stories from your life as a spy. So these are stories that you were okay. They were okay with you to release, or you had to change a little bit?
I had to change everything, and they're the best stories that I could tell, because there are some stories that no matter how I try to write them, I couldn't do it in a way to protect the sources and methods. So the agency, obviously, as I am, we don't want to reveal who these people are. That's the most important part. But for the agency, they're also worried about revealing technique. They're worried about compromising cover, right? Like, what was I doing in that country? If I name the country, they have to explain where I was. Was I working in a US government facility? Was I there as a business person? Well, those are the things they kind of protect. So it made it hard to write, but you know, what I try to convey in my story, it's a story about espionage, which is about people. And people are all about relationships, and it's beyond skin deep, right? It's about their hearts and souls. So I couldn't say, oh, he was, you know, a 6 foot tall Egyptian with fair skin because he came from Alexandria. I would just capture that person as a person. Was he hard? Was he soft? Was he gentle? Was he musical? Because that's what counted more in the relationships and developing them. It's kind of getting into their soul. It really is, in a corny kind of way. And I'd like to hope that at least that part of my descriptions still came across as I describe the characters. And with that, the agency was okay. As long as it wasn't compromising of where, well, how I was doing it, and anything that would lead people to figure out who it was. But that sometimes took some negotiation too. There were a couple of chapters they took out entirely. They just felt that it was too much, and no matter how I went about it, they wouldn't accept it. Honestly, I think some of those cases were more, they were embarrassed, because my anecdotes all helped to try to illustrate a point, which is the agency changed after 9/11. The culture of the organization went from being a secret spy service that prided itself on safely, securely recruiting the most important agents of the world and keeping them alive, to a place which was more about paramilitary activity, more about the use of force, and less about being using finesse and stealth, which I'm hoping they're coming back to based on the needs. The needs these days are for all those qualities, because great power competition, the rivalries we have, the sophistication, you're not gonna be able to solve that through brute force.
So you also cover like, what is it like to be like modern spy? Because everybody have this idea about the spies that we get, you know, but it's really not.
Yeah, I wish I was compared to Roger Craig, but it's never happened, and it's never going to, you know? So, you know, spies are people who more fall into the background, who you don't notice, like me, you know, who has nothing particularly remarkable about them, who's also not necessarily the sort of center of topic of conversation that wants to be the center of attention. It's got to be somebody who can encourage trust. It's got to be somebody who could also be a little vulnerable. Because, you know, how do you get somebody to be vulnerable about themselves emotionally, what I'm saying, right? And talking about their hopes, their wants, their needs without being a human being. So you could be all super duper cool and Roger Craig or Sean Connery and what have you, or you could be like, you know, a cut-up and the total comic who just wants to hear himself talking. And obviously I'm not talking about any of you gentlemen, but I'm talking about just sort of the used car salesman stereotype. I'm not pointing fingers. But who's going to trust that person? You trust somebody who knows going to be discreet, who knows going to be reliable, who you could trust with your secrets. And that's somebody who's in that really weird kind of place between just extroverted enough and just introverted enough to kind of hit the sweet spot. When I talk in my book, and I even, when I was an instructor at our training academy, The Farm, I would tell the students that they need to be interested and interesting. Right? They need to show enough interest in somebody, because people like that. You know, you're asking about me, you want to hear me talk, you want to hear my stories. That's cool. That's validating, right? You're interested in me. But you also got to be interesting enough that they care to keep talking to you. Like, okay, I'm done talking about myself. What can you do for me? Yeah. What is there about you that I want to see you again for coffee or lunch or whatever like that? So there's got to be enough of a narrative that you got, your persona, that you're interesting, but it's all about keeping it focused on the agent.
Hmm. That's interesting. And you also talk about, you know, different identities and different jobs that you have. You tell people that, you know, different names. Do you have like set names? Do you get to choose those names and you just set up, or and jobs, or just like it's given to you?
So without getting into too much detail, when you're operating in Alias, if you're operating in another name, you need what we call backstopping, right? Documentation, you know, things that people could check. And think about how hard that is today with technology. I can't just today all of a sudden make up a new name and identity, because you go on Google and do internet searches, and if there's no history to this person prior to 6 months ago, you're going to think, that's a little bit odd, right?
I actually think it's easier.
Oh, because
you can build. Because you can build like, I mean, I've done it. I'm an engineer as well. But I'm saying, like, you can build, right? Especially the CIA. You can build history.
Not to be genuine. Not that you could check every record. People do it in the movies, right? They create this whole life story. But to actually create a life persona today with technology and search engines and stuff like that, it's really hard to do. There's different things we do now to operate artificially, which are a lot more secure. Okay. So for example, if I've gone into a country with a retina scan or takes fingerprints, I can't go back to that country in a different name, no matter what my persona is, right? Because they're going to see, your name is John Jenkins today, and 2 years ago, you were Doug London. There's something funny about that, right? But back before technology, yeah, you'd get false passports, and you'd get a persona, and there'd be some sort of backstopping, you know, somebody to answer the phone, whatever. It's a bit more complex and sophisticated. It's still something we do, but it's different than people would think.
Is this naive? Because that podcast I listened to said something very similar. They brought up the retinal scanners about how, you know, they scan you when you come in, internet history. Yeah. Is it naive? Because to me, it sounds like if you're the CIA, like, do you really not have access to Facebook in a way where you can literally back in time create a profile for someone that goes back 20 years? Do you really not have contact lenses that can fool a retinal scanner? Or like, is that just movie stuff? Or is it naive to think that that technology is not something so impossible?
So technology is there, right? There's also legal authorities too, especially if you're dealing with a company that's a US company. Facebook is a US company. So right. Would you ask their permission if they give their permission? But would they do that because of the legal, you know, exposure, right? But the bigger question is, do you really need to? That's a tremendous amount of effort. If you're talking about, which I'm sure like technically you can do, you could create a person and Photoshop or do whatever and go back 20 years. You also can't create real people. So people have engagements with people over their lifetime, right? And if you investigate that, you'll see your pictures in their life stories. So think about the complications of really doing that. And then think about, is there an easier way I could do it? And the answer to that question is yes, and still get what you're trying to achieve, that disassociation from the US government by using a trained intelligence officer. There's other options that we have that are easier and actually more secure than going through all those hoops.
I would find someone who looks just like the agent who just died recently. And then erase the record of that and then have them take over their profile.
You're very smart, because that's something criminals do. And that's something that the Russians have done. No, genuinely, the Russians have. And you see it in the show, The Americans, right? If any of you have seen that show?
I have not, but it's been recommended to me based on my name.
I can't watch really any spy show because they get really unrealistic and I get all crotchety and cranky. But The Americans is pretty decent. But the story they're telling are about Russian illegals. Now, the idea of an illegal is like just that. They actually want to take a Russian person and make him seem or her seem like they were an American from the beginning. So they would look for like kids who died, you know, babies, you know, people who died at birth or what have you, and then try to create a life. That's still a lot harder to do, because even if they send this illegal young in age as a 25-year-old, they still don't have a life story from age 2 to 25 to where they then could have sort of an operational background. But it's an idea and it's an approach, and criminals still do that.
Do you know who Marwan is? Ashraf Marwan?
Ashraf Marwan.
He's one of the most famous spies in the Middle East. It's just that there's so many.
The one that the Netflix production did, the Egyptian.
They did.
Course, yeah.
So he's very famous because he is the one spy that Israel claimed that he's Israeli, and they give him the Medal of Honor of Israel, and Egypt claimed the same thing and give him. Until now, we don't know which was he. And that just shows you how brilliant he was, wasn't it?
He's like Epstein.
Except we know what Epstein's size is.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's an open question still, indeed. Was he really an agent for the Israelis, or was he a double agent? I think he kind of, in a way, maybe served two masters, because he really did, if you look at the history of that case, he provided the Israelis the warning of the 1973 war. They didn't take it.
But he provided them like five different times.
Yeah, exactly. And the Israelis kept dismissing him. So I really don't think the Egyptians would have wanted to leak that to the Israelis.
Yeah.
So I tend to think he was really an Israeli agent, if you just take that one thing, because, you know, the Arab coalition came really close to winning.
Yeah.
Why would they have wanted to tip off the Israelis?
Yeah. Yeah. That's another, you know, but, you know, one of the, you know, crazy stories of this, I'm very interested. And I was, you know, also the one with the, you know, with the American trying to get everybody from the Iranian embassy. They did a movie production and all that.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty. We had John Cypher here before. Do you know him?
I do know John.
Yeah. And I told him, like, somebody should write a book about the stupidest operations in that. Because I think the one that the Saudi did, killing this guy and not knowing that they were recording it at the same time, must have been the most dumb operation I've ever had. I mean, this is laughable. Like, right? Like, even the way they did it, go in separate cars and both cars have bodies apart. Like, it's crazy. Like, right?
Yeah, that wasn't exactly the best tradecraft. But no, there's plenty of stupid stories. And you know, things go wrong. And sometimes things go wrong because you make a mistake or you do something stupid. And sometimes things go wrong because there's just so many complexities to control. It's really, when you have human beings and circumstances and you've got timing at play and who's going to be in the street at any given time, things can go wrong really easily beyond your control, which is why case officers have to be able to adjust to, we use the buzzword, dynamic circumstances and fluid situations. But that's really the crux of it. There's a lot going on out there.
How do you make the case generally for, like, the, because again, I just listened to that podcast a few days ago, and like their conclusion at the end, their little like tidbit, the New York Times, of course, does, like, you know, the CIA isn't able to operate like they used to, as effectively, blah, blah, blah. And the question people ask, like, is that bad for the world? Of course, being the wink of like, is the CIA good for the world, is like, and of course, that's the New York Times take, because whatever. But that notwithstanding, you know, among people like myself who might be into like hearing about an Operation Northwoods or like, you know, CIA funding, you know, certain things, or like there was like most recently, I feel like the one I heard about was they used a fake vaccination thing in Pakistan to like try to get bin Laden. And so, you know, you have these individuals that make cases of like these operations that are, is it a thing that's good for the world? Like, how would you make a case generally for the CIA to separate it from these individual instances, whether true or not? Like, is what is their central mission? Like, is it just to promote American interests? Is it to promote some sort of like their own interest?
That's a really fair question. I teach a grad course at Georgetown, right? And it's about human intelligence operations. And one of the key areas of study for the course is spying ethical? Should we spy? You know, what's the value to it? And I, you know, I have my own personal feelings, which obviously I share with the students, but I also give them a lot to think about, because I've even always said for myself, spying is an unethical business that I've always tried to do according to the most ethical standards, because I wouldn't go as far to say the means always justify the ends, because I don't believe that. But I do believe what the agency does, you know, actually keeps a lot of people safe. Now, it's not altruistic for the world. It's not about, you know, peace and harmony for the world. It's about American interests. What keeps Americans safe? And we hear more about the failures, obviously, than about the successes. But a secret organization, if it's your front line of defense, its job is to prevent you from having to go to war. Its job is to give you advantages so that a terrorist bomb doesn't go off, so that a new Russian fighter isn't more sophisticated than our American counterparts. It's about providing defenses and avoiding catastrophes and preventing actual armed and open conflict. So to that end, when an intelligence service, any, not just CIA, it's doing its job right, that's what it's doing. And you don't hear about the successes because we wake up every morning and there's not a nuclear a mushroom cloud, okay? My issue that I talk about with the agency is I felt it got away from that a little bit. And it got away even on the intel collection part from its core mission. CIA was created to be a strategic collector. And in fact, just kind of throwing about a bunch of dumb words, steal secrets that matter. The CIA is actually listed as the collector of last resort. It's supposed to go after the things that are so important but can't be achieved any other way. You use espionage or sabotage in order to get it. Those have to be life and death kind of things. The CIA's mission throughout post 9/11 period was more combat support, providing military support, if you would, even if it's intelligence, tactical to the US military in the various theaters of conflict or to support its own covert action activities. Now we're talking about great power competition. That's more of an existential threat. The Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, if they have a nuclear missile someday, the North Koreans, they literally can blow us up. I mean, they can end our lives tomorrow, today. That's a real important threat. Being able to keep us from going to a conflict where people are using those weapons, that's where you need a secret organization. That's where you need the CIA to either collect the intelligence to keep us in the advantage or to keep our opponents from being able to do their bad will against us or against our interests overseas.
And if we don't do it, they still will.
Yeah,
that's the problem, you know, and it's we talk about the differences, particularly with, you know, autocratic regimes, you know, where we've taken some kicks to our democratic system, but we're still a democracy at the end of the day. Hope to God we stay and we get a little stronger in democracy. But, you know, Russia's not a democracy. China's not a democracy. Neither is Iran. Countries that could really harm us, they don't have to worry about the press. They don't have to worry as much. They still have to worry a bit, but about public opinion. So it's a lot easier for them to do bad things that are, one, unethical, or two, could be harmful even to their own people. But for us, because it's a secret organization operating in an open society, that's a trick to do, right? And to do it right, the threshold, the bar is a lot higher, which is why I think the bar for what we collect and what we do should be likewise high. It should be important and justify what we're doing.
And most of these countries have like intelligence, they spy on their own people, just like they spy on the rest of the world.
And that's their primary mission. All these countries, their intel services, their number one requirement is protect the regime. Whether it's Putin, whether it's Xi in China, whether it's the regime in North Korea or Iran, their whole intelligence focus is on, one, finding their own people, seeing what they're doing, having people keep an eye on them, and having informants. And, you know, in a police state, an autocratic society or an undemocratic one, you get to a point where people can't even trust their family and their friends because they're just a history of people being turned, sometimes with blackmail. And so I think sometimes the CIA is kind of a healthy kind of change for them when we approach them, because we actually let them quit if they want to.
And that was one, like, part of, like, my question earlier about, like, the best intelligence services. I feel like, you know, the CIA, the Mossad especially, and the Egyptian, I have to put them there too, the intelligence, is because they don't try to protect the regime. They try to protect the country, the idea, the whole thing, the big picture, you know, like you said, from annihilation, from all that. That's why they so, you know, because they really believe in what they do. You know, they if they fail to do that, you know, bad things could happen.
When you mentioned this, the intelligence agencies, they're like the best one in the world. You did mention China, and I'm curious, like, you did mention China in that list. China in that list?
What I would tell you about China is very good technically in terms of cyber. They're very good at working ethnic Chinese, whether they're, you know, their own countrymen who travel abroad or ethnic Chinese who are part of the diaspora in different countries. They're not very good at that traditional cultivation and recruitment. And part of it is because they're themselves, it's a police state. And they don't have that freedom to sort of act as a CIA or a Western case officer can. They're not themselves trusted. And they're not themselves in a position to kind of cultivate a positive relationship. They'll be very black and white about, you know, money, what's in it for you, or blackmail. So they're good on technical collection, you know, hacking into systems and such like that. They're actually not very good about traditional espionage, recruiting agents, because the agents want to be a partner to them, other than their own nationals.
How does that work? I don't know if you follow, there's a journalist, Josh Rogan, who's been like on a big China thing. And, you know, I wonder if it has to do at all with us putting so much effort into counterterrorism in the past 20 years. But he goes over all these different ways that they've compromised. You know, they have lists of China friendly governors that they've approached. They buy land strategically in America that's like near, you know, whatever assets that they're interested in. They have like lists of like U.S. universities that they don't like, stuff that's really like subtle and seems like normally if it wasn't a Chinese Communist Party so closely related to all their educational institutions and everything else, it almost seems innocuous. And it seems like over 20 years, they've slowly, like, there's honeypot stories with China and like U.S. officials. There's like all this different stuff where it seems like all of a sudden they own large assets in America. They own, and there's this gray area of who they is, whether it's what we previously saw as private organizations that turn out to be, you know, ultimately she is like pulling back on capitalism over there. He's getting tighter on any company over there that would normally be seen as private. He's talking about the reunification of China. And I know the CIA's previously supported like freedom in Tibet. We like funded the Dalai Lama, right? The CIA at one point was like sending money. I don't know if that's like proven or not. My understanding is that's like an out in the open thing that we gave money. And now they're talking about, you know, Hong Kong and Thai. I don't know how much it's in the U.S. interest to like fight, have a physical battle over Hong Kong and Taiwan, but that seems like that's where the CIA would step up and prevent that from ever
actually
happening.
Yesterday also CNN reported that the CIA will open a mission center in China. I don't know why they announced that, but it was all over the news.
It's not in China. They're opening a China mission center.
Yeah, a China mission center.
So that means they're creating a new office within CIA that just focuses on China. So China previously was part of the East Asia Pacific Mission Center. Mm-hmm. So they included all the countries of East Asia, with the exception of Korea, that had been separate. But now they're breaking out China into its own mission center, and they're actually bringing Korea back into the East Asia. But to your point about what the Chinese do well, the Chinese take advantage of open source collection. The Chinese take advantage of contacts. So espionage is when you're recruiting a spy to secretly perform a mission for you, essentially seeking secrets, providing secrets, doing things that are illegal. What the Chinese have done is they have a tremendous ability to vacuum what's available in open source, and they use a lot of wining dining of contacts. They're less worried about getting to that point of a secret relationship, and they're kind of more onto having a good contact that might speak out of school because they might think they'll get a deal with a Chinese company or with the Chinese government. So it's a method of collecting intelligence. It's a different kind of intelligence. And they do that pretty well, but it's a step short of what we would call classic espionage, which I think the United States and the Western services do a bit better.
That makes it sound like they almost like, I don't want to say fooled us, but it seems like they've gotten so much influence in American media in these legal ways by just throwing tons of money at whether it's Hollywood or like the Belt and Road Initiative. Now they've got all these stuff that we used to do. They like throw money in to help build a port, I think in Sri Lanka, where they have an indebted system where because they can't pay it back, China now owns like 80% of that port. And so it feels like that this is a thing they've done so well all around the world without maybe doing things illegally. Although I'm sure I've heard of like, even in the US, I think in Canada, didn't they like arrest two people that were working for the Chinese government? But like in general, it just feels like over a period of time, they figured out how to like exploit our system almost in order to gain leverage and power through all these assets. Like, are they outsmarting us in this way just because they're not illegally stealing the secrets? Do you think they've like caught us off guard?
I think their goals are a bit different. A lot of China's goals are economic and technical advantages. So a lot of their intelligence collection is on technology transfer, on getting technology that they want to replicate or get ahead of. And that's what a lot of their collection and a lot of the things what you talked about was based just on that, was focusing on, you know, companies, American companies in Silicon Valley, the defense industry, particularly the computer industry, right, across TCOM, because they want to get technical advantages. The United States, we don't use our intelligence community for that, essentially. We use our community for national security. So we want to know, you know, what are the Chinese going to do in the South China Seas, in the Pacific, right? Are they going to threaten us? Are they building a new base? Would they invade Taiwan? Would they, you know, use force, violence in Hong Kong? So we use our resources accordingly. China wants to find out, can we get American chip technology so we can steal that and make it even better and we can sell it? Because China's driven by different needs. You know, you're talking about a country that needs to economically improve every year at a ridiculous pace because they don't have democracy. They don't have an open society. So the best way to keep their people content is to improve the quality of life for over a billion people. So whereas the US, we complain if we don't grow by more than 3 or 4%, China has to grow by 10% or so every year. Otherwise it's worried that, okay, our system, their communist system, people are gonna start complaining, and it's, and there's no way in the world that China can simply through force put down a rebellion of over a billion people. So the economy is a lot more important to them. What you're talking about, their strategy in the developing world has been very much that. They'll go to impoverished countries. Sri Lanka is a great example. A lot of countries across Africa. A lot of this is part of their Belt and Road Initiative in South Asia, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and go, you need a port, you need an airport, you need whatever factory, no worries. We're gonna lend you the money to pay us to send our materials and our people there, and we'll take care of it for you. That's really not good for that country anyway, because they want their own people to be working. They wanna be able to choose where they spend their money and maybe build some things. But then it becomes a point where these countries can never pay it off. And China knows that. So then China can then take over the airport. They could take over the port. So for them, a lot of it is economics and how they seize greater wealth.
So in your book, two things I want to discuss quickly, because it really kind of captured the whole life of a spy, like from beginning to end. But two things that I don't want to give too much of the book, but one was, you know, I saw a show and the detective was sitting and it was just watching and somebody was complaining. And it's like, this is the job. And you have something like that, hours of just, you know, doing nothing, and then moments of adrenaline, you know. So this is like when you talk about the, like, how, what motivates you, like of just like spending all this time absolutely doing nothing, not doing nothing, but not nothing interesting.
So, you know, what you're talking about, it's true, right? And I wrote it in my book that, well, we would think, you know, the American public is like the action of the actual meeting an agent or running around in the streets is short, but all the time that goes into planning that is still work. So, you know, what a case officer has to do is different than a normal person. So, you know, a normal American who's working overseas, whether it's in a business or at an embassy or whatever like that, he or she can do what they want. They can go where they want, when they want. A spy, a case officer, has to create a persona where they have a whole routine, a pattern of life that allows them to spy, that allows them not to seem suspicious, that allows them to be in certain parts of town at certain times where it won't stand out, or to hide their movements so that anybody tracking them won't even know where they are. That's 24/7, you know, every day. It's not like you can kind of say, you know, I'm going to take the night off and just stay home and watch movies. So I'm going to call the local service and say, you know, boys and girls, don't follow me tonight. I'm not actually working. Yeah. Everything you do is measured, assessed, and documented by foreign governments. And if you're dealing with one that's a real kind of denied area place, right, an autocratic state which doesn't trust the United States, and they think every American's a spy. So they're watching every American, and they're looking for all the patterns. They want to find out who they think is a spy. Your job as a spy is to make sure it's not you, that you're in their eyes, boring, routine, what have you, that they're going to follow, you know, the political officer because the political officer is talking to the opposition or talking to the press. So that's 24/7. Everything you do as a spy is deliberate. Where you go, when you go, how you get there, the routes you take to sort of factor into things you're doing later. Because when I'm going out to meet an agent, nobody can see me. The whole idea is that it's concealed, so I can't be followed. I have to know that I'm clean, and there's a whole big procedure that I'm not allowed to discuss about how we do that. But all that is built up by what you do every day, 7 days a week.
And you end the book with a warning. I don't know if you want to discuss that or touch on it a little bit.
Well, you know, the bottom line of my book is what will help the agency do its mission best is looking internally at itself and being more accountable, not airing its dirty laundry so that we're getting agents killed, right, to the public, but at least as opposed to having senior people circle the wagons to protect themselves or dismiss problems, acknowledge it, deal with it and address it. And beyond that, become a more representative organization of the United States. I can tell you, I believe in diversity because it's the right thing to do and it's the moral thing to do. It's also the good spy thing to do. The United States is a melting pot, right? Or whatever you want to call it, but it's represented by people from all over the world who are Americans now, right? Who are either naturalized or first generation or what have you. But let me ask you this, if you and I are going to go spy in Alexandria, who's going to stand out more?
Yeah, you.
I'm the old white guy. Yeah. Right. So having somebody who's an Egyptian American, who's Egyptian and understands how the country is and speaks a local dialect, having somebody who's a person of color in places where I stand out, that's good for spying. They bring gifts, culture, language, history. They're smart. Right. So just kind of recruiting the same sort of, you know, privileged suburban white kids, male white kids, probably not in the best interest of the organization. So what I want the organization to do is get back to its roots, be a premier spy service, take advantage of the diversity and inclusion, and speak truth to power. Because without that, it's not going to have much credibility when it's trying to convince people that there's dangers out there we need to do something about.
How many non-binary or trans spies do you have?
You know, I would tell you that the agency has at least been open and pursued trying to bring in people from the entire LGBTQ community and their representative. I think it needs to be that sense of openness where it's not a big deal anymore, where we're not bringing in people to have like a, oh, we need somebody from this community. It's because we're taking people that represent everything we need to represent ourselves overseas. But it's definitely changed. I mean, in my days, in the early 80s, it was literally a sea of white men, mostly white Catholic or Presbyterian men. That's changed a lot, but not enough, and certainly not enough yet at the senior ranks, where they've got to be representative in the decision-making process at the really top levels of the agency. And I'm hoping that's just a matter of time.
Last question. If you unless somebody have another question, but I know you have to go. In Iraq and Afghanistan and all that, what is your experience? You know, you worked in that region for a little bit. What do you think we did? Like, what's your take on the whole thing?
Depends on your measuring stick.
Yeah.
I would tell you my bottom line is that we failed to figure out the most important lesson, which is with terrorism, you need to address the conditions of terrorism. You can't just use attrition. You can't just use force and keep killing people. Because you're going to basically create a more challenging dynamic of decentralized organizations. You're going to be the narrative for the recruitment posters to bring more people on board to extremism. So what the CIA did very good was finding terrorists. And I think that accounts for why there wasn't a repeat of 9/11. There were some catastrophic terrorist activities. Spain had the train attack. London had the bus attack. We've had lone wolves in the United States who were inspired by or even directed by these organizations, but we haven't had 2,977 human lives lost in one catastrophic event, which then we sort of overreacted to, I think, in some ways that maybe hurt us. So I think what we needed to do was get back to spying and try to use knowledge and narrative. Let's find out what our threats are and then find other ways other than force, be they economics, diplomacy, covert influence, right? Propaganda, whatever it may be, to change the conditions, but we didn't do that. In Afghanistan specifically, we spent 20 years doing the same thing. On the CT side, yeah, we found a lot of terrorists and we minimized the threat of terrorist operations from Afghanistan, but we left it with the same conditions in which we found it, where those conditions, particularly the Taliban, are going to come again. There will be threats in Afghanistan. It's undeniable that's going to happen. But had we thought, all right, instead of trying to make Afghanistan look like the United States, let's see how can we make Afghanistan look like Afghanistan, but be peaceful. What works in Afghanistan? What fits their history, their culture, the demographics of what's essentially a very, you know, a society where it's not monolithic. I mean, even the Pashtuns that make up the Taliban's base in Kandahar are completely different than the Haqqanis, who come from Khost and Paktika province. But we always wanted to have, let's have a U.S. Constitution, a U.S. model for the army, a U.S. model for the government. And then when we left, it absolutely reverted back to what we found in September of 9/11. So my belief in this is going to be a little bit good, a little bit bad, depending on what your crowd is. I think we would have been better off revisiting our entire policy, trying to maintain the status quo long enough to keep terrorist threats from hitting us, while thinking, how do we do this better? Or if we decided that there's just no way, it's broken, we can't fix it, and we absolutely have to leave, at least a smarter way to leave than the way we did.
Absolutely.
I have one last question, if that's okay, Hatem.
Sure. Yeah.
So this book is obviously not a whistleblower book. You're taking great caution not to like compromise anything. You're working with the CIA. So in that case, what made you want to write a book? Did you just always dream? Were you writing poems and dreaming of being a writer the whole time you were spying? Or were you hoping you could release your journals? Or, you know, you're obviously not blowing any secrets. So is this just you've always wanted to entertain in literary form?
I didn't think haikus would get me on podcasts, for one thing. But a whistleblower in my mind is somebody who sees something illegal and works within the system and goes to the IG. I didn't see anything illegal. In some ways, I saw things that were worse. I saw a compromise of the agency, which I believe undermined its mission to protect the people of the United States and to do its job. I saw a cultural shift. I saw people making choices that served them as individuals and them as opportunists politically, but not the country, not the mission. So I left the agency with a number of demons that I wanted to exorcise. And I wanted to start a conversation because I believe there's an important balance between transparency so the American public trusts the CIA, but accountability, which is internal, so that it makes the right changes without having to be compromised in the New York Times. I initially wanted to do that through a novel. I thought, you know, the things I want to say, maybe I can make a novel. But I started writing and I kept coming back to anecdotes. And I thought, can I write my anecdotes in a way that at least get people talking, that the conversation I want to hear is, you know, we really need the CIA. It's important to our security. We need the CIA to do its job right, the right job in the right way. And it hadn't been doing that for the last 20 years. And if that conversation got started, then yeah, that was my goal, in the way that didn't make the CIA weaker and didn't get anybody hurt or killed, particularly sources and my colleagues.
Well, thank you so much. This is great. And if you want to know what happened to operation officers when they grow up as well, you can read the book. it's I think it's very interesting. The recruiter spying and the art, the lost art of American intelligence. It's everywhere, right? Amazon and all over.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Whatever, you can get the book. Well, thank you so much for sharing and being here. Boris, you want to share information where people can find you and all that?
At the Boris K on all the social media stuff.
And Noam, anything interesting this week? The Secret Lady Show? Well, we can say that.
No, nothing interesting this week.
Okay, well, there's a Secret Lady Show, which it's a secret lady, somebody, well, we can say who. Go to the Comedy Cellar, you know. Douglas, would you like to share your information or people can find you and follow you on Twitter and all that?
Yeah, please. I'm at Twitter at DouglasLondon5. There must be four other Douglas Londons, but hopefully none is entertaining. So DouglasLondon5 on Twitter. My book's available everywhere. Cheap plug, shameless plug. But I think it'll give you a different perspective of spying and tell you a bit more about the people side of the business.
Thank you so much. And who's going to be the next Bond? And who do you want the next Bond to be?
Nobody's called me yet. I keep waiting. I was hoping the book might help. But no, I don't know. I'm not in enough with the younger generation to know who'd be the best next Bond. I love Roger Craig. I thought he was cool.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much. And this is Live from America podcast. Have a good day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.